You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, mites and insecticides meant a bad year for Wisconsin bees and beekeepers. We'll find out why.
First, about a dozen prisoners in Wisconsin plan to launch a hunger strike in the coming days. The protest is aimed at ending a form of indefinite solitary confinement, among other things. It's set to begin this Friday and is based at Waupun Correctional Institution. But at least one supporter of the strike says it could spread to other prisons.
The hunger strike comes at a time when issues of solitary confinement are being talked about all over the country. States like Colorado and California have banned the use of indefinite solitary confinement. In addition, President Obama banned solitary confinement of juveniles in federal prisons earlier this year.
Here with us now to talk more about the upcoming hunger strike is Dee Hall. She's the managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Dee, welcome back.
All right, thanks for having me.
Well, Dee, you write that this strike is aimed at ending a form of indefinite solitary confinement that officials, I guess, typically use to keep order in the institutions. What kinds of things are we talking about here? Can you describe it for us?
Well, it's called administrative confinement, and what it's intended to do is to separate prisoners who are considered to be dangerous from other prisoners. Also, any prisoners who are thought to incite violence or group violence, gang members, people of that nature that they have decided are a danger to the proper and, you know, orderly running of the institution. I received a lot of information, including a lawsuit from somebody who was confined for 25 years in this status.
And this is not considered a punitive form.
Right. Officially, it's non-punitive. But the conditions that are described in administrative confinement are fairly similar, if not identical, to solitary confinement. So it's at least 23 hours a day in a cell by themselves. The few times that they are let out during the week is just very briefly, and again, it's on their own. You know, they're escorted by a correctional officer to the showers, to a single recreation cell.
Do we know about other demands from the hunger strikers?
They're asking for several things. One thing, of course, is to eliminate administrative confinement altogether, and that would be replaced by a maximum 1 year in solitary regardless of what the circumstances are. They also want some more oversight of the way the state uses solitary confinement. They believe that it's completely unmonitored by anyone outside of the prison system. There's some concern and calls for improving mental health care among people who are in solitary. There's a well-recognized connection between mental illness and psychological, you know, distress and spending all of that time on their own. And finally, there are some prisoners who are claiming that the state is running some type of mind control program, and they would like to have that looked at as well.
Tell us more about one of the prisoners at Waupun who will be striking. You've written about him in your piece. His name is LaRon McKinley Bay.
So, yes, LaRon McKinley Bay is the one who has claimed in a lawsuit, it's a federal lawsuit filed against the State Department of Corrections, that he has been held in this status for a quarter of a century. It began after he escaped. He shot a guard. He shot a sheriff's deputy. Another one was injured in this very high-profile escape attempt. And since then, he has been in administrative confinement. So he is an example of what we're talking about. He's probably a more extreme example because of the length of time he's been in there. But he has tried to escape a couple of times. He's been successful with brief escapes. He's had violent encounters with both correctional officers and other inmates. And so he's considered a danger to the institution.
Now, he's been in there for over two decades, but apparently, as you write, Dee, that the practice with each individual will be reviewed every 6 months. Do you know why that isn't enough or isn't working?
In some cases, it's reviewed after 6 months, and then they are released from administrative confinement. What he's saying is in his case, in the case of some of the other prisoners who filed the lawsuit with him, that these are, quote, sham hearings that really don't result in release of prisoners who deserve to be out of this status.
Now, there are some outside groups supporting those who will be doing the hunger strike. What do we know about who's involved? Who are the players besides the people hunger striking?
Well, there's a group called the Industrial Workers of the World out of Milwaukee. They are supporting the hunger strike. Today Wisdom, which is the statewide faith-based prisoner advocacy organization, has also said that it stands in solidarity with the prisoners. It's not trying to encourage them to hunger strike, but saying that that they should be supported in their desire to change these conditions.
We're talking with Dee Hall right now, managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She recently wrote about an upcoming hunger strike planned at Waupun Correctional Institution over the use of long-term solitary confinement. And Dee, so far we know that this is a planned hunger strike. It has not gone into effect yet, but obviously the institution, the Department of Corrections, knows about it as well. So how do they plan to handle it? Is there any sort of procedure in place?
They have not revealed what the reaction will be, what the official reaction will be. I know that there are circumstances in which if a prisoner goes too long without food, that they can get a court order to force feed them, which is kind of a very uncomfortable situation for the prisoners. They're not at that stage yet, so I don't really know.
And Wisconsin has taken some steps to try and reduce solitary confinement in the past. What do we know about what the DOC has already done?
Well, they've, pardon my voice, I'm really sorry. they have reduced the maximum time that you can be in solitary from 360 days to 90 days for any infraction, a disciplinary infraction. Beyond that, though, they continue to have this separate set of prisoners who are in administrative confinement, and that, as we've said, can go on indefinitely.
And Dee, we'll leave it there. Thank you for joining us. That was Dee Hall, managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She recently wrote about an upcoming planned hunger strike at Waupun Correctional Institution.
Bees across the country have been struggling with die-offs linked to insecticides and the varroa mite. It's a problem that farmers, beekeepers, and scientists have been tracking for a number of years now. And last year turns out to have been an especially bad year for beekeepers and their bees here in Wisconsin. 60% of honeybees in the state died, a rate beekeepers consider unacceptable.
Nate Beck reported about the issue for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. Nate, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Well, can you put the numbers in context for us? How bad is the 60% die-off rate for honeybees in Wisconsin last year?
So many beekeepers consider 15% to be an acceptable die-off rate from year to year. So if you're looking at 60%, that's about, you know, four times, you know, what is manageable. And in six of the last 7 years, the bee die-off rates have been above 30%. So we're kind of in a period where strong bee die-offs are kind of a common occurrence.
And so does that take it to the point then where it's unsustainable? A beekeeper can't maintain their hives from season to season without some imports.
Sure. So yeah, basically, you know, we spoke with a beekeeper here in Fond du Lac. She has seven hives. And all seven of those hives died off in the last year. So basically, she's importing all of her bees from, you know, from overseas, in some cases from Russia, but also from California and the South. So they're coming from all over. Imports have really become a big way to replace these dying stock of bees.
And I want to talk more about the importing of bees in a little bit, but first, what do we know about why the bees are dying off in Wisconsin and why it seems to be at a rate that's higher than the rest of the country, at least it was last year?
Sure. So I guess the primary reason, according to the USDA, is the varroa mite, which is kind of an insect that invades a lot of the beehives. And, you know, basically, if gone untreated, it can, you know, kill off some of these hives. Also, you know, insecticides are partially to blame, used in cornfields, and then lack of wildflowers and other structure in fields can also cause a lack of food and cause the bees to die off.
Talking to Nate Beck from the USA Today Network. Wisconsin, about bee die-offs, particularly bad in Wisconsin, particularly bad this winter. And we want to hear from you, by the way, at 800-642-1234. If you're a beekeeper, we'd like to hear your story. If, crossed fingers, things have worked out okay for you, or if you've had this problem. Are you getting out of beekeeping? If you're a farmer, do you rely on local beekeepers to help keep your fields going? Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Nate, that's the ultimate worry, isn't it? That there might not be enough hives of these honeybees to fertilize fields, to pollinate fields.
Sure. A significant chunk of Wisconsin crops, you know, rely on honeybee pollination from year to year to continue to sustain themselves. I mean, there's a saying within the beekeeping community that, one third of every bite you take comes from a bee. That's fruits, nuts, and the like. So they're really kind of an integral part of, how we eat food and our quality of life. So.
Well, Nate, let's talk about the importing of bees. I know that some of the beekeepers you talked to were in the importing business, which is something I didn't really realize was booming as it is. But tell us about what happens when people in Wisconsin import their bees. Where do they come from? How does it work?
So we spoke with a gentleman in Rhinelander. He has built quite a growing business there. He travels from California during, I guess, peak bee season in the spring and brings back semi-truck loads of honeybees to the state and distributes those across the upper Midwest. So basically, this year he'll haul about $750,000 of bees alone, and that's not counting all the beekeeping supplies and whatnot that he brings back to Wisconsin. So people are reliant on it, and there's quite a bit of demand.
And you wrote that demand may be exceeding supply, given that this is not just a problem here in Wisconsin. Bee importing may be booming, but there may not be enough bees to import at some point.
Sure. Yeah. People in California are kind of faced with the same problem. Bees aren't dying off at quite a quick pace there. But this guy in Rhinelander, Chris Hansen, he had pre-ordered about 4 semi-loads for Wisconsin and was only able to pick up about 2.5 or 3. So folks out there are also being faced with this.
And in terms of that particular bee importer that you're talking about, he also talks about the price spike that's happened in terms of importing a hive. It's gone up quite a bit, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's correct. About 10 years ago, if you wanted to get a hive's worth of bees, it would be about $35 or $40. Now it's about $140. So it's really kind of shot up as bees have died off and more folks have tried to get into this market. So,
are people leaving the market, especially beekeepers who, like the one you mentioned, lost all of her hives? Are people calling it quits these days?
You know, it's kind of interesting. This beekeeper in Fond du Lac, she says that at some point it may become unsustainable. But, you know, with media coverage sort of around this bee die-off rates, a lot of people are actually saying, hey, why don't I give beekeeping a shot? So you've got a lot of backyard beekeepers and amateur beekeepers that are trying to get into beekeeping, to try and sustain the populations now. But that kind of creates its own set of problems, too.
And you talked to some beekeeping associations, at least one, I think, that was based in Door County, and they said it's sort of a moving target right now, figuring out how to keep hives healthy. So how are they adjusting to problems like this big die-off from last year?
Sure. So basically, beekeepers have a couple of different tools to fight the varroa mite. One is called oxalic acid, which is a chemical compound found in rhubarb leaves. And then there's also over-the-counter varroa mite treatment strips that you can buy. So beekeepers now are really kind of using a combination of both to try and treat these varroa mites. And then there are, other treatments like essential oils and whatnot, but really it's kind of a process of trial and error. Beekeepers see oxalic acid treatments as almost a necessity now to try to mitigate their bee losses from season to season.
Is there a hope of maybe breeding a bee population that might be more resistant to this varroa mite down the road?
Sure. The University of Minnesota, I believe, is kind of working on this. There's some folks here in Fond du Lac are hopeful that eventually there may be a bee that is bred that can better resist that. But right now there's some thinking that Russian bees are more resilient to the varroa mite. But that's kind of up to interpretation, I suppose.
And are they optimistic, beekeepers in Wisconsin, about the future, given this bad year that they're trying to bounce back from?
Sure. No, I think beekeepers that we spoke with here are, see their job as a critical one, and one that's really important. I think it's sort of an uncertain future, and I wouldn't say that beekeeping kind of in the future will cease to exist. But yeah, it's going to take some time to really kind of figure out what best is able to control the varroa mite.
You mentioned, in addition to the mites, insecticides being seen, commercially used insecticides being seen as part of the problem. The people you talk to in the bee industry, are they hoping that there are changes in how those insecticides get used?
Sure. And the interesting thing is, there's a lot that just the basic, homeowner can do to try to, create an environment that's helpful to bees. If you're spraying insecticides, don't do that during the middle of the day when bees might be flying around. You can do that at night. Read the labels. Sometimes insecticides can wear off after a few hours and not be harmful to bees. Make sure you're checking that. And then you can also kind of plant wildflowers and other things that bees like to keep them so that they can continue to feed on that. So.
Let's take a caller now. Tom is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I was just listening. I think just a couple of points that probably need to be made in terms of pollination and agriculture here in Wisconsin. Most commercial beekeepers who bring in hives for pollination, they don't overwinter their bees in Wisconsin. And there is a large commercial beekeeping industry that consists of migratory beekeepers moving from state to state to pollinate crops.
And Tom, what was your second point? We're a little short on time.
Well, my second point was that those are the key things to keep in mind, that the commercial honeybees are not native to North America. They were imported to begin with from Europe.
Tom, thank you for those points. I appreciate that. Little short of time. And Nate, any word about taking the bees somewhere else in the winter?
Sure. I guess as northern climates are more affected by these honeybee die-off rates, I guess I wouldn't doubt that. Some folks I spoke to, though, were overwintering their bees here in Wisconsin. So I think that there are folks here who are trying to make that viable. Not every beekeeper has the resources to take their stock elsewhere.
Nate, thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure. Thank you much.
Nate Beck is a business reporter based in Oshkosh and Fond du Lac with the USA Today Network, Wisconsin.
The U.S. Food and Drug Administration announced new voluntary guidelines for the food industry last week. Their target, the added salt that's found in much of our packaged and processed foods.
According to the FDA, the average American consumes 3,400 milligrams of sodium a day. That's 50% more than the federal government's recommendation, which is a limit of 2,300 milligrams per day. So what might these new voluntary guidelines mean for the food on your plate? And what questions are still out there when it comes to salt and salt intake?
Allison Aubrey is with us now. She's a correspondent for NPR News, where she covers food, nutrition, and healthy living. She also writes for NPR's food blog, The Salt. Allison, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, it's great to be here. I should mention I'm on a train, so if you hear a little background noise, that's what it is.
All right, that's good. That's ambient sound. We like that in public radio, don't we?
Right.
So we've got these voluntary guidelines for the food industry saying, hey, food industry, let's have less salt in the packaged foods. Is it going to make much of a difference being voluntary?
Well, I think what you're starting to see is that the food industry is already responding. You have to remember that back in January, we got new dietary guidelines, and in those guidelines, the message was loud and clear. Look, we need to be consuming less salt. Leading food companies, including Nestle and Mars, are already beginning to reformulate some products. And so though they're voluntary, I think that there's a lot of momentum for change. When the FDA set these new targets, they basically said, hey, food industry, work with us. We're not going to, you know, come up with some kind of targets that are impossible to meet, but we want you to help us figure out what's the best way to start reducing sodium levels for food.
Now, looking into this story and where salt is coming from, when we think salt, I think we think of reaching for the salt shaker and putting it on our eggs or popcorn or whatever. It sounds like that's not where we're getting most of our salt. A lot of it comes in pretty sneaky places, even our bread.
That's right. I mean, the vast majority of our sodium intake, about 75%, as you point out, doesn't come from the salt shaker, but comes from the processed foods and the restaurant foods. And I should point out, you know, half of our food dollars are spent outside the home. So this is, you know, a big part of our diet. I have a little diagram here of the story that I wrote last week, and it shows some of the salty six the American Heart Association came up with, the six saltiest foods in our diet. It includes bread, pizza, cold cuts, soup sandwiches, and chicken. So, of course, we like to think of, you know, we know that potato chips are salty. What we don't think of is all the sodium in our bread. One slice of bread can easily have 200 milligrams. And this is a category the FDA is saying, hey, bread makers, let's get together on this. And we figure out how to maybe reduce sodium by 20 or 30%.
Right. And you show in that diagram in your piece how quickly that sodium can add up. A lot of us, when we have sandwiches, we use not one but two slices of bread. So that's 400 milligrams. Then those slices of turkey add a lot more. That one sandwich gets us pretty close to that RDA.
That's exactly right. The diagram shows, you know, one slice of cheese, you got 310 milligrams. So easily you can get to 1,500 milligrams with a sandwich. And not even really sense like, oh, hey, that was a salty meal. Not think of it as a salty meal at all. And as we pointed out at the beginning, the goal here is to get Americans down to 2,300 milligrams a day. That is one teaspoon of salt. Currently, Americans are at about 3,400 on average. So looking for about a 50% reduction here for most Americans.
Talking to Allison Aubrey from NPR News. She covers food, nutrition, and healthy living. Looking at new voluntary guidelines from the FDA saying food companies, try to get some of the salt out of your packaged and processed foods in particular. Allison, let's look at the health side of this. A lot of people for years have been talking about salt being bad for us. I had my family, my dad was put on a very low salt diet years and years ago. The science seems to be stacking up. Is there general consensus that above a certain level, salt is bad news for most of us?
Yeah, and the key word there is most. You know, Tom Frieden, who heads up the CDC, came out last week with a commentary in the New England Journal of Medicine, basically saying slashing the average sodium intake by 400 milligrams per day could potentially prevent as much as 28,000 deaths annually. And so there's a lot of data on this. I mean, basically what happens is that excessive sodium increases blood pressure, hypertension. Hypertension is a major risk factor for heart disease and stroke, which are top killers in the U.S. And Frieden points out, like, look, there's a dose response here. The more you consume, the higher your risk of developing hypertension, particularly over the age of 50. Now, a lot of people say, hey, I've got low blood pressure. My blood pressure is 90 over 60. Why should I worry about this? And a doctor might say, you know, for now, you don't need to worry. But over time, many, many Americans tend to develop hypertension. And as we point out, that's when you're at higher risk for these diseases that kill so many Americans.
Now, when I read comments on stories like yours, a lot of people point out, oh, well, you know, you need some salt. Salt is a necessity for human life up to a certain point. Cutting back too much on salt could be harmful. But as Americans, we'd have to try really hard, wouldn't we, to get to a too low level of sodium intake.
I think that's right. I mean, there are rare exceptions. You know, when the Institute of Medicine looked at this 3 years ago and came out with a report, they did find that for some people, for some outliers, there is a risk of having too low sodium. I'm recalling that people in the late stages of congenital heart disease, you wouldn't want to put them on a low sodium diet, but that's not a big percentage of the population here. And as you point out, look, we're awash in processed foods. Most of us eat processed foods daily, so it would be very, very tough to get us down to where we'd be worrying that we are consuming too little sodium. That's not a big concern here.
Is there a particular concern about food marketed towards children and the levels of sodium in it?
Well, you know, children's diets really mirror our diets as adults. There was an analysis that the CDC did a few years ago finding, kids consume about 3,300 milligrams a day. That's almost exactly what we consume. Why? Because we tend to feed them what we eat. So, I think the focus here is on helping people understand that eating habits are established when we're young. So if you get in the habit of having salty foods all the time, that's going to be a problem later on.
So looking at the state of the art in processed foods, in our lunch meat, our frozen meals, you name it, why so much salt? How do we end up here that it has so much sodium in it?
Well, I mean, there are lots of uses for sodium. We think of sodium, of salt, as something, as a taste element, which of course it is, and, you know, a lot of us crave salt. But salt is also used as a stabilizer, a texturizer, in bread products. I mean, think of pizza dough. You use a little yeast. You need the salt to get the yeast to rise, to get that nice rising crust. And so sodium has many, many functions in food. And that is why the FDA is not sort of saying, you know, across the board, everybody reduce sodium by 30%. That wouldn't work because you do need a certain amount of sodium to make certain foods work, like rising pizza dough. On the other hand, the FDA is saying, look, the low-hanging fruit here are categories like salad dressings and pasta sauces. You know, they found a lot of variance in these pasta sauces and salad dressings. Some have, you know, relatively little sodium, some have a lot, and they're sort of saying, if we could look around at all the different categories of food, we think that a lot of progress could be made in these categories where there seems to be a lot of sodium added that doesn't need to be added.
Let's bring in a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Don on the line in Eau Claire. Don, hi.
Hi there. I am 93 and a half years old and a retired physician. When I was in medical school years ago, the advice and in subsequent years, the advice regarding salt usage was that if you had normal blood pressure, if you had no pre-existing illness that would predispose you to hypertension, there was no real scientific basis for you to restrict the use of salt in moderation. The FDA in the past, I believe it was the FDA, has attempted several times to suggest that people just as a blanket measure remove salt from the diet or markedly restrict it, and they've backed up on it.
Don, I want to bring in our guest in on this. Thank you so much for calling and sharing your experience. I guess the key word I heard from Don there, Dr. Don Allison, was in moderation, and that's the tricky bit, I guess, defining what level of daily sodium intake is in moderation.
I think that's right, and also you have to remember, he said he was 93, so years ago, you know, 40, 50 years ago, I don't think there was as much sodium from processed foods in our diet, so a lot of the sodium, and people weren't eating out as much either, so a lot of the sodium in people's diets is what they added with the salt shaker, and that's really no longer the case. So since food makers do really control how much sodium we're getting, because that's the number one source of sodium in our diet, I think the idea here is, hey, let's work with the food industry to see if we can't start, you know, not drastic reductions, but if all these categories cut by, you know, 10 or 20 or 30%, that could make a big difference.
We're talking right now with NPR's Allison Aubrey. We're looking at new voluntary guidelines issued by the FDA that target added salt in our food, especially processed and packaged foods. Also looking at the role salt plays in our diet and our health and the possible consequences of eating too much of it every day.
You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the FDA taking a hard look at the amount of salt in our food? Are you personally trying to limit your salt intake? And if so, how hard is it for you? And what questions do you have about salt, sodium intake? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with NPR's Allison Aubrey, and we're looking at new voluntary guidelines issued by the FDA that target added salt in our food.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your questions about salt and salt intake? Do you think less salt in our food supply would be a good thing? Do you avoid salt? Are you trying to cut down? Is it hard to do once you start reading the labels at the store? Never mind what you might be getting at the local restaurant. If you work at a restaurant, do you feel like you're using a lot of salt in the food? Do you try to dial it back? Use some other spices instead. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers. Mike with us in Algoma now. Mike, hi.
Hi, how you doing? My question has to do with sodium that's in softened water. Many people in Wisconsin have their water softened. They are replacing the calcium with sodium. And how does that correlate with the FDA guidelines? Is that included in that minimum or maximum that you can have?
Mike, interesting. I don't know that the FDA was looking at that. Allison, is that something that that anybody's tracking?
I do not know that the FDA is looking into this. What the FDA issued last week were target reductions for categories of food. So they were simply looking at food. So I'm sorry I can't help you answer that question, but it's an interesting thought.
All right, we'll bring up Paula now in La Crosse. Paula, hi.
Hi. I'm a registered dietitian, and I just wanted to comment that I wholeheartedly agree with the recommendations, but I also just wanted to comment the processed foods, eating out, the growing number of people that are doing that leads to this overweight and obesity, which attributes to so much of our hypertension and all these other health complications. So I think it's a great step in just helping people in regards to trying to choose healthier foods.
Paula, thanks a lot for that call. And there have been accusations geared at the food industry, Allison, that basically they're giving us tempting little bundles of salt, sugar, and fat, and that might account for a lot of the health problems. But you said some food companies are already getting out ahead and trying to get some lower salt products. Are they trying to not be seen as the bad guy here?
Well, I think what's interesting is that sometimes you can reduce sodium and not even have people realize it. We tend to taste the sodium that's external on food. So we taste the chip. We know that's salty, right? All that salt is right there on the outside. A lot of times with processed foods, think about pizza dough, for instance. You don't necessarily get that salt sensation. Might not be until the next day where you kind of think, oh, gosh, that seems really salty. You don't taste it right away. And so oftentimes you can make stealth reductions. You can get, for instance, DiGiorno Pizza, which is owned by Nestle. The spokespeople there told me that they have successfully cut back on sodium in those pizza crusts by, if I'm remembering correctly, 11 or 12%. And you know what? Nobody notices. So you can make stealth reductions with a lot of foods. I would say that's probably also true in these other categories that I've mentioned, including, you know, pasta sauces and salad dressings.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Adam on the line in Kenosha. Adam, hi.
Hi. I found that in my own diet, it's easiest for me to control salt simply by switching to whole foods. I generally don't keep processed foods around the house, and I don't know, it just makes it easier to make that decision. I will say the one, I guess, processed food that I typically have around the house is cheese. How can I not? I'm from Wisconsin. But the other thing I wanted to mention real quick is that salt doesn't actually make bread rise. Salt controls the rise, controls the expansion of the yeast during the fermentation process. So, I mean, it's a critical factor to keep the yeast from growing out of control, but it doesn't, in addition to adding flavor, it doesn't do anything more than control that growth.
Interesting. Adam, do you do a lot of label reading when you're shopping at the store? Or when you say whole foods approach, are you buying, you know, vegetables and fruits and raw materials and not even getting into something that's going to have that label on it?
Yeah, exactly. I do a lot of my own cooking. Cooking's my hobby. It's my passion. I love to do it. And why would I buy something else somebody makes when I can do it better and I get a chance to exercise my hobby?
Adam, thanks a lot for sharing that. A lot of people have moved in the opposite direction, though, Allison, haven't they? Processed food sales, packaged food sales, and, of course, and you mentioned earlier, restaurant food sales. doing pretty well. We're moving away from cooking for ourselves like Adam does.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that there are a lot of public health experts out there, you know, cheering on Adam. You know, cooking at home and using whole foods is obviously an approach that, you know, we're told is healthy. It's also time-consuming, and I think the thing that really pushes people towards the consumer packaged goods aisle is a lack of time, a lack of preparation. So, I mean, given, you know, that we're in this convenience-driven food world, the food industry realizes that it's got to step up. And I think that a lot of the progressive companies will put money into R&D to figure out, you know, how to reduce sodium, thinking about portions. And, you know, the food industry knows that all eyes are on them, and there's a lot of pressure.
Talking to Allison Aubrey from NPR News. She covers food, nutrition, and healthy living. We're talking about new voluntary guidelines from the FDA trying to get food companies to put less salt in packaged food. I understand that last year, Allison, New York became the first city in the U.S. to require a chain restaurant menus to print sodium warnings if a dish exceeds all by itself that 2,300 milligram daily recommended limit. Do we know if that kind of food warning, and we've seen this for calories too, if that's something that changes consumer behavior?
Well, what we do know right away is that once the chain restaurants realized that they were going to have to post warnings, they didn't want to, so they reformulated. That happened even before the law went into effect. So there was immediate movement from the food from the restaurant industry to respond, because they know that the consumers don't want to see a big red warning next to something that they're ordering. So that's the way it changes consumer behavior. It, you know, it nudges the restaurant industry to make changes.
Back to our callers now. Walter is with us in Chippewa Falls. Walter, hi.
Hello. I wanted to comment about a couple of things that we need to remember is that the reason people like salt in their food is that originally salt was very hard to obtain. So looking at ways to control that drive to consume salt is one of the things that I think we need to look at. The other is that I was personally glanced at quite askance when I was a kid because I wouldn't automatically salt everything. And it drove me crazy sometimes.
You know, people want, you ain't got a salt in eggs, boy. What's wrong with you?
Walter, thanks a lot for sharing that. Yeah, it always, when I see people salting fast food fries, which are already pretty salty, I always wonder about that. But that is, this is maybe, and I think evolutionary scientists have wondered about this, this is a core drive. Salt used to be a scarce nutritional commodity, so that's why our bodies respond so well to it and want to keep going back and eating salty foods. Is that part of what we're fighting here, Allison?
I think so, sure. I mean, look, same reason we're attracted to sugar. Sugar's instant energy, you know, fastest way to get energy to the brain. Same with fat, right? Where people, our ancestors lived through times of great want. And so, yeah, we're kind of programmed to like salt, sugar, fat. Yeah. And that's now working against us.
Walter, thanks so much. Eggs, I'm sorry, they're one of the things that I do actually, one of the few things I add salt to. Allison, as we start to wrap up, these are voluntary guidelines. Have people been saying, hey, FDA, this isn't far enough. We need involuntary guidelines. We need limits on the amount of salt in certain kinds of processed and packaged foods.
Well, sure. I mean, I think what happens in this case, as one of the callers pointed out, this has been a long process. I mean, the FDA had its first hearing that I covered about whether to regulate or, you know, limit sodium 10, 12 years ago. And I know the conversation started long before that. It's been very difficult for all the reasons we just laid out. Salty food is tasty. It's used as a way to preserve food. And it's been a very hard thing to get under control. I would say, you know, the American Academy of Pediatrics came out with a statement saying, you know, this isn't saying, you know, this is voluntary and not mandatory, but it's a practical step, a sort of step in the right direction. So I think most people see this as a step in the right direction.
Allison, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thanks so much for having me.
That's Allison Aubrey. She's a correspondent for NPR News, where she covers food, nutrition, and healthy living. She writes for NPR's food blog, The Salt. She joined us to talk about new voluntary guidelines aimed at reducing the amount of salt in packaged and processed foods.